podcast this week, Excelsior! Nuff said, true believers! That's right, we have the star and director of The Testament of Anne Lee, Amanda Seyfried and Mona Fassbold. Sounds a bit like Stan Lee, James, come on.
Yeah, I was following it at a distance and then I got it and I was like, oh, yes, okay. I should have seen that coming.
Hey, true believers!
Nuff said, Spider-Man!
Yeah.
Okay. All that plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that didn't finish the story of how we nearly stepped on Florence Pugh's dress. But we're back and we're going to finish the story any second now. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm in the pod booth joined by 1, 2, 3 colleagues of such lethal cunning. Helen O'Hara, Geek Queen. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Mike Munzer, Horror Evolver.
Hello.
Making his debut on the full Empire podcast after lots of appearances on the spoiler specials.
I've gone beyond the velvet rope. I feel very special.
We've pulled it back and you've stepped.
And now I get to hear about Florence Pugh's dress, apparently.
Oh my God, Mike, this story is going to blow your mind when I finish it. But first, hello, James Dyer.
Hello, Chris.
How are you?
I am approaching this podcast, as always, with a certain amount of trepidation.
And dread?
A little bit of dread.
Because you want to know what your new nickname is this week?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, because Tin Jim didn't quite stick last week, did it? Although I was very pro Tin Jim.
Well, it rhymed, you know, and that's nice.
It kind of rhymes.
Semi-rhymes.
Yeah, semi-rhymes.
I mean, it rhymes pretty well.
Yeah, but N and M, you know, it's close.
Oh my God, you're such a rhyme fascist.
Who amongst us here doesn't appreciate a semi-rhyme? Yeah, from time to time. From Tim to Tim. This week, we are asking people to send in suggestions for James's new nickname going forward because the Camino Kid just ain't cutting it anymore. It just ain't cutting it. Charis Pollard, there's a whole thread on Blue Sky. Charis Pollard says, my nickname for James would be Armadillo, in line with the classic Dime Bar? How do you pronounce that?
Dime Bar
adverts as he's crunchy on the outside.
Soft on the inside.
And soft on the inside. He's hiding a teenage girl interior.
I mean, that is an accurate description of me, and yet I don't like the nickname.
Actually, aren't Dime Bars hard on the inside?
Yes, they're soft on the outside, hard on the inside. Okay.
They're the opposite to armadillos. Right?
Hang on, they're soft on the inside, hard on the outside.
No, Dime Bars are soft on the outside and hard on the inside.
How does that work?
Well, it's biscuity goodness on the inside.
It's like, biscuit, it's like a solid almond type.
It's like caramel.
Describe it to me. I've never had a Dime Bar.
You've never had a Dime Bar?
No, I've never had a Dime Bar.
God, you leave such a sheltered life.
Well, the best way to experience it actually is to go to Oxford to an ice cream shop called George and Davies and then buy Dime Bar Crunch ice cream, which is excellent.
Or go to IKEA and get the Dime Bar cheesecake.
Yeah, but it can be dry sometimes.
Oh,
you know?
You with your dry.
Are they still a thing?
Chris has gone.
Has literally left the building.
Chris
we can only assume to go to IKEA.
And get
the cheesecake comes pre-assembled. So, you know, that's handy.
What's happened?
That's helpful. Oh, he's back. I guess
someone needs to let him in. Let Chris back in the room.
Fucking door wouldn't open.
Your commitment to the bit is commendable.
Helen, Oxford was closed.
No. Oh dear. In that case, you're just going to have to go to your nearest IKEA, which is pretty close to you, and get some Dime Bar cheesecake.
All right. I went to the Inspector Morse Museum. That was open.
Hey.
I probably spent too long in the Inspector Morse Museum, to be honest. And then by the time I got out, Oxford was closed. Well, that's exciting. Anyway, back to James's nickname.
Armadillo?
Absolutely
just
not.
Armadillo.
No.
Armadillo Dyer.
No.
Armadillo? Armadillo?
We're getting close to dildo territory. Let's not go there.
Please don't call me that.
So Alvin Shum replied to this, saying, I was going to suggest The Uninvited because James didn't get Dracula tickets. Helen and I went to see Dracula with Cynthia Erivo. Last week, we didn't go with Cynthia Erivo. She was on stage. And that's where I nearly stepped on Florence Pugh's dress, the story of which I'm about to finish just as soon as I finish James's nickname. So Alvin Shum said, also you're banned from all pancake-related defense with Helen O'Hara. Helen replied to this saying, he ate all my carefully grated cheese.
I did.
To which
I
then
had like a whole system, like a station set up.
Helen,
I
put it to you that if you leave it lying around in a bowl, someone's going to eat it.
Well, that's what a couple of the replies said.
And that someone is me.
Yeah. It was definitely you. Yeah.
Hi, it's me. He's a problem. So Jonathan Root then replied to this saying, there's a nickname for James, the Cheese Gobbler.
You are not rooting for me. Absolutely no.
Cheese goblin.
I'm yes. not going to be a cheese goblin, a cheese gobbler, none of those things.
It's not the sexiest nickname.
No, it's not. It's not the best. I'm thinking, because bear in mind, whatever this is, I'm adding it to my Hinge profile. So I really do need this to sell me in a good light.
Please, please do. Please.
The cheesy goblin.
Cheesy, you're going to get some odd matches.
I mean, I feel this is all more Field than it is Hinge.
Wow. James Dyer is the cheesy gobbler. Gobble, gobble. It's turkey time.
Oh, no.
That would surely get you a lot of matches on was it Twinge?
Twinge.
When I see James's profile, I feel a twinge.
Twinge is the over 50s dating app, I think.
Oh, my back.
Yeah, it's all those deadlifts you were doing.
Mike, do you have a nickname, Mike?
I don't think I do, no.
Should we give you one? If you have a suggestion for
I don't know, I like this.
All right. The cheesy gobbler has spoken. Let us move on to this week's question, which comes from Blue Sky once again. This is someone who sent in a question last week, and I liked it, but we already had a question last week. And so I saved it for this week. And when I say I saved it, I mean I lost it. Whoa, here it is. Daniel Watkins, Daniel LeW on Blue Sky. Give up one movie-related thing for Lent because we are in the middle of Lent. Helen, as a Catholic, we know all about that. Helen, do 1 minute on Lent now. You can't hesitate like I just did or deviate or whatever else they do in that show. Right. 1 minute on Lent. Go now.
I lost the belief in Lent and with it a lot of my belief in organized religion when I discovered at the age of about 7 on entering a small supermarket with my mother that sweets were still stocked during Lent. And that made no sense to me because, of course, everybody gave up sweets for Lent, right? That was my belief.
She is repeating repetition.
I'm allowed to say Lent again. And I was outraged because I thought, well, hang on. I thought this was what we all did. Uh-huh. You had to give up sweets for Lent. And upon learning that that was actually voluntary and I had been giving up sweets when I did not need to give up
sweets. There's a lot of sweet repetition.
We've uncovered some trauma. Do you want to lie on the couch?
I gave up on religion, really, at that
She's
point.
She's so close.
Wow.
She's 10 more seconds.
What I'm saying is Lent is nonsense, unless you fancy cutting back on something.
Helen has denounced Catholicism right here on the Empire Podcast. I have lured her into my trap. I've been sitting there for years. Would you agree, Helen, the Protestants are the best? All right, Mike. Oh, so the question from Daniel the W is, what movie-related thing could you give up for 40 days?
Any movie-related thing?
Could you abstain from watching
it? Horror movies.
Horror movies, Mike.
I could not. I would do about as well as Helen did with sweets, apparently, as a kid, if I tried to give up horror.
When did you last see a horror film?
When did I last see a horror film? Scream 7. About 24 hours ago. That's about as long as I can go, Chris. What would I give up? I would give up trailers, watching trailers for 40 days and 40 nights. You know?
That seems easy. I feel like that's a bit of a cop-out. That's when you give up a specific chocolate bar, but not the rest.
Yeah, it's like when you give up vegetables.
It's like me saying, I'll give up dime bars.
Yeah.
Giving up trailers. I judge you. Hell's Bells?
I mean, I could give up the MCU for 40 days.
Fuck
and then
off.
Just have a
sorry,
triumphant return afterwards.
How dare you?
Helen, I think Chris is about to declare you excommunicado from his podcast.
But like then, you know, you have a comeback and
she's still here. I'm clicking my fingers frantically.
And you watch all the films again before Doomsday comes out.
You go for longer than 40 days without watching something MCU, right?
If you go for longer than 40 days, the pleasure when you watch an MCU movie is immeasurable.
Oh, no.
I haven't watched an MCU film since Endgame. Like, that was the last MCU I watched. I shouldn't be in this room, should I?
Have you seen Ready or Not? Start running now. I'm not even kidding.
Time to run and hide.
Wow. Jimbo, what would you give up?
Well, you know, films.
So you wouldn't notice any difference?
Yeah, it'd be like you giving up dime bars. I'd just stop watching films completely and only watch TV. That's what I do.
I don't know.
Okay, but you're not allowed to mentally replay Aliens or Die Hard.
Oh, come on.
No, you're not allowed to think about them.
Helen piles criteria upon top of criteria.
I've noticed this. Yeah. She's shifty.
Mm. She is shifty.
What would I struggle to give
like
up?
If you're, yeah, because I I don't think I've watched an MCU film in over 40 days. You know, that's just something that...
No. Do you know what? Because obviously the point of Lent is it is a period of kind of like penance. And so you do have to give up something that you like. You can't give up, okay, as you say, vegetables. I can't give up, for example, art house films because, honestly, I think I would have to
give up... You'd have to go on at
right,
art
this
house
is what I'm
films.
Saying. I would have to give up mainstream cinema. Mm. That would have to be my sacrifice. I give up mainstream cinema. I can only watch things that have limited release in no more than, say, 30 cinemas nationwide.
Oh yeah.
You know, I'd have a maximum budget of, I don't know, like 900 quid or something. That would be student films. Anyway, so you know what I mean? But like, I'd have to set parameters which would keep anything, you know, blockbustery, commercial,
yeah,
out of my arena. That's yeah, what I'd have to do. God, it'd be the worst month of my life.
I don't know. It's a really tricky question because I couldn't give up watching films for 40 days because it's my job.
Well, yeah, this podcast would be interesting.
I mean, yeah, I couldn't give up talking to people about films because it's my job. It's my job.
Could you give up wearing film-related T-shirts for 40 days?
Of course I could.
Do you have the washing?
Do you own other things?
Do I have the... I mean,
Is Helen just throwing shade at your fashion? Do you have anything else, Chris, you can wear?
She's coming in hot today.
I am wearing a Tommy Lee Jones T-shirt as we speak.
I cannot sanction this buffoonery.
Right now. Procured for me by Jeremy Dillon, occasionally of this parish. Thank you, Jeremy, for that. And I could, and I wouldn't miss a beat.
All right.
I wouldn't miss a beat.
But what would you like, let's be honest, like from a watching capacity, if you had to give up a thing, because like you could totally give up Marvel movies for a month, because let's be honest, they don't come out that often, so we could
rewatch them. That was my workaround, really. Yeah.
So you could totally do that.
I don't have to rewatch a real
sacrifice.
In terms of things I watch?
Well, something that you know that means a lot to you that you would struggle to be parted from.
If you take original Law and Order from me, I will pry the eyes from your skull.
Maybe some TV shows.
I am loving Law and Order right now. I work from home quite a lot, and I've fallen into a routine where I work until about 1 o'clock, and then I make myself lunch, and I sit down, and there's a Law & Order marathon on 5 USA, Channel 141 on Sky, every single day. OG Law & Order, so the good shit, with Jerry Orbach as Lenny Briscoe and Sam Waterston when he was Jack McCoy. He wasn't the DA then, when they sidelined him a little bit. He was the ADA, principal crusading ADA, fighting for what he believed was right, which a lot of the episodes I've been watching recently has been the death penalty. He's been fighting to execute a lot of people, which doesn't sit well with me, but anyway.
Fun story, Law & Order has a measurable effect on juries and makes them more likely to convict.
And CSI had a measurable effect on juries as well, because they put a greater weight on forensic data.
Extremely troubling.
Well, that aside, I mean, it's a great show, and I'm loving watching it.
I was going to come at you for your resistance to all peak TV and your insistence on watching old things, but actually, we were having a discussion on the Pilot TV podcast today about precisely this, that these kind of network procedural shows, there's something quite comforting about the formulaic structure of them. It's quite reassuring. It's why a lot of people love SVU in particular. But also, it's the kind of TV that if you are doing other things and you drift off for a while, it doesn't really matter.
It's quite a nice palate cleanser from the
which is why they're so
stuff.
popular, because also like they're standalone, right, because they're completely episodic. So if you miss a series, three series, or Law and Order's case 20 25 series, it's absolutely fine. Pick up what you left
spoken
off.
Like someone who does not watch Law and Order.
I've seen Law and Order UK.
I've seen Law and Order UK.
I just put on the first episode of Boston Legal.
So good.
Denny Crane.
So good.
Great show. But talk of Law and Order brings us neatly onto our second question this week, which comes from SBC1972 on Blue Sky. Which film set around courtrooms would you least want to be a juror in? You can disregard that. Objection, overruled, sustained. Which is it? you can do which you'd like to be a juror in or least, and which would you happily attend just for the drama?
So
Helen, who trained to be a barista.
Oh, God. Barrister. Yes. Barrista. So To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes.
Maybe I could sway the jury in the right direction and convince them to be less racist and return a verdict of not guilty, which the accused in that film definitely was not guilty.
So you would use your powers as a juror
I would attempt to do so, yeah.
Would you be a rural juror?
I would be a rural juror.
This is exciting. This is real good.
I don't think mine would be as moral as that. I think I'd like to be something like A Few Good Men, just to watch them yell at each other, just
no
to get
jury,
a front
exactly.
row seat.
There's no jury
in
that.
There's no jury in that.
Yeah.
12 angry men then, you know, that'll be a fun one. Right?
Just anywhere where there's angry men. That's
yeah,
what
I want men to shout at each other in front of me.
12 angry men's an interesting one because that's a really unpleasant looking jury room. It's really hot. They're all really miserable.
Yeah, actually, they are having a terrible time, aren't they?
Yeah. On the other hand, like being juror number 8 would be... pretty cool. But you'd have your work cut out for you.
Yeah.
But it'd be pretty cool.
I was, when I was in college, I was in 12 Angry Men. I was juror number 4, who is, I believe, E.G. Marshall in the Sidney Lumet film.
Okay.
And he is like a very reasoned, very intellectual guy. You can see the way they went for me. I slicked my hair back.
Good. Wow.
I had a lot more hair back then. And I slicked it back and I put on some glasses and I adopted, now I realize this has not aged well, but I adopted a Kevin Spacey-like aspect for the role.
Wow.
Because I thought cold, intellectual, you know, I'm going Spacey. So I went Spacey. You never go full Spacey.
It was a different time.
It was a more innocent, joyous time. But juror number 3, which is the Lee J. Cobb angry role.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one as well.
That's
and
a good
of course,
one.
Juror number 8 is the Henry Fonda role. Mm. Those are the three biggies, I think. He says... put themselves up the cast list. I was probably 4th or 5th build. But I think people really come away from it going, juror number 4, I like that guy. That's not what I would say, but Jimbo, what would you go for?
I don't even remember what the question was.
The question was, which jury would you not like to be on?
Or
like to be on. It's entirely up to you.
So many things. I'd like to be on the jury for Primal Fear.
Oh.
I would like to experience that twist. In person.
But you wouldn't...
But the jury
no, you're right,
know.
The jury doesn't know. The jury doesn't know, because it all happens afterwards.
Well, they do get to see him kind of psycho...
Royale. Yeah.
And he... last time.
Yeah, it's so good.
Mike, any more before we wrap this bad boy up?
Courtroom dramas are not my forte. I can't think of any others.
What if it was Freddy Krueger on trial? Would you like to see that trial?
I'd love to see that, Chris.
He never got his day in court, did he?
I know. So unfair. So unfair.
Also, the song doesn't go up to 12. It stops at 10. Just saying.
One, two.
Juror number 3 is coming for you? I don't know.
Yeah.
Minority Report.
Minority Report.
Because you get to have the trial before the crime. Saves time, efficient.
Oh,
really good idea.
Yes, that system's not flawed at all, as seen in the hit movie Minority Report.
I don't build the torment nexus. Stuff.
Don't call it a torment nexus. Maybe don't do that.
But another one that would be fun would be Runaway Jury, right?
Yes.
That was the one I was going to say.
That is a good one. That is a good one.
I fucking love Runaway Jury.
I don't know Runaway Jury.
Runaway Jury, great film. John Cusack. Rachel Weisz, Dustin Hoffman and Gene Hackman.
Amazing.
They have a great scene when they're in a bathroom being angry at each other and they're pointing at each other, as only Hoffman and Hackman can do. It's based on a John Grisham novel, and John Cusack plays Nick Easter. I know this movie too well.
Yes,
and,
you really do.
And he gets onto a jury deliberately so he can tamper with it. And sell the verdict to the highest bidder.
Yeah, and prove that he controls the jury room.
Yes.
Nice.
It's real good.
It's real good.
Love that.
I love a Grisham.
That's what, and you know, angry men pointing at each other. Like I said, that's what
God.
I want. That's what I want.
Hackman, Hoffman.
Yeah.
Pointing at each other.
That's what we want.
You cannot get much angrier than that, can you?
Helen, if you were on a jury, would you have been swayed by Nick Easter? Do you think?
I probably wouldn't have needed to be swayed. / would have been thrown off that jury for being openly left-wing and anti.
Oh, you wouldn't have gone through
place.
The jury selection
process.
I don't
think I would have got through selection unless I wouldn't have got through unless I pulled a Nick Easter and hid all of my viewpoints about everything.
Oh.
Yes, because you would find that so easy.
I know, right?
All right.
I'm a
okay.
very subtle person.
Are there any great courtroom drama scenes in horror films, Mike?
Nah.
Ghostbusters
2. Yeah.
Count. The Sclary Brothers.
Ghostbusters, yeah.
The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
That is a courtroom.
That's
sort
a good
of
one.
Thriller, isn't it? Yeah.
Are you object?
Yeah.
Out of order.
But no, I guess they skip a lot of the sort of legal...
Can't imagine why.
the hurdles.
I think it's an interesting unexplored terrain,
people
right?
People should sue more... like slasher killers.
No, but Chris had a great idea once for one time, Chris had a great idea for a horror sequel that would basically pick up with the hero survivor of the first film being put on trial because he's the only person still standing and they would obviously think he did it because it was actually a supernatural entity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a lot of horror movies where, I'm sorry, the final girl or whoever
would be suspicious.
Immediately be arrested.
Yeah, absolutely.
They turn up covered in everybody's blood, mm-hmm. probably holding an axe or a knife in their hands, just as the police come up at the end.
Yeah.
With some nonsense story about demons
exactly.
and, you know, deadites and, oh yeah, I cut my girlfriend up with a chainsaw. My fingerprints are all over that chainsaw. Yeah, of course. But it wasn't me. She was possessed at the moment, but at that time, by a Kandarian demon.
Yeah, and also it wasn't me doing it. It was my disembodied hand, not my real hand.
And how did you summon this demon? I played a tape cassette that I found. You would absolutely, you know, Ash, for example, just to name one, he'd be looking at 25 to life. Man one.
Yeah, he'd be screwed.
Man one. Oh, boy.
Up and back to Law and Order again.
But, have you seen Red Rooms, the French-Canadian film from a couple of years ago?
No.
That is a really scary horror film, courtroom drama.
Really?
That's the only one that springs to mind.
What happens in that?
Oh, it's really, really dark. But it's essentially a trial of a kind of serial child murderer. And there is a woman who is kind of obsessed with serial killers and true crime. And she kind of finds a way to sneak in and watch the trial. And then dark stuff starts to happen involving her and her obsession with serial killers.
Wow.
It's very, very good. I would massively recommend. But that one springs to mind as a kind of good, really genuinely scary courtroom film.
Is
horror film.
The Exorcism of Emily Rose frightening?
Yeah, I thought it was.
It's got some scary contortions.
Oh,
that's
no,
the main thing I remember.
It did
that's scary.
It did a fucking number of me in that movie. Absolutely. Did a number of me. I was awake, bolt upright all night long after watching that
at
movie.
At 3 a.m.
3 a.m. 3 a.m. came, 3 a.m. went, and I was like, oh, no, nothing's happened. Okay, I can go to sleep now. But no, it really did a number of me. I've told Scott Derrickson this. It's delight. But yeah, it'd be oh, God, what if you had like a movie where they were putting the devil on trial? And there was a jury that could call it the devil's jury.
Lovely. I've been watching, going back to like slightly naff network TV shows, I've been watching that show called Evil.
If you say naff, it's one of the better procedurals out there.
I mean, it's because it's made by the Good Wife people, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's the Good Wife, but with demons and devils and exorcisms and stuff. It's fun. I've been enjoying it.
Luke Cage himself.
He's great. And that is definitely one of those shows that I've been happy to just sort of half watch every day, you know, at the end of an evening. It's nice.
Like Law and Order, in fact.
Yeah.
Which brings us full circle once again. There you go. So thank you so much indeed for your questions this week. I think we're going to go somewhere else next week. We're going to go away from Blue Sky. I'm not quite sure where yet. It might be our Discord channel, might be the subreddit, it might be Twitter, it might be Instagram. Keep them peeled on my socials and I will let you know where to send us questions for next week's show. Oh, I still have to tell you guys about how I nearly stepped on Florence Pugh's dress, but we've got to move studios. We'll be back in 2 seconds with the news section. That's exciting. And then Florence Pugh's dress. Okay, we are back, but in a completely different studio. Shall we talk about some movie news?
If we must.
Let's do it. If we must.
If we must.
I do insist upon talking
if
about movie news on this movie podcast.
Mm.
So I guess there's only one place to start, and that is with the BAFTAs. The BAFTAs took place at the weekend. Now, obviously, we're aware of the incident that happened at the BAFTAs this week involving John Davidson, the inspiration behind I Swear, and onstage presenters Delroy Lindo and Michael B. Jordan, and of course in the audience, the production designer of Sinners, Hannah Beachler. All we're going to say is that it was an awful situation for everyone involved, and our hearts go out to everyone involved.
Yeah, I think people should have been immediately apologized to and comforted, and were not. And I think broadcasts went out that should not have gone out.
the BAFTAs themselves, let's talk very quickly about the results on the night. Did anyone watch it? Did anyone pay attention to it? I must confess I didn't.
I sort of half watched.
Yeah?
Yeah.
One eye open.
One eye on what was going on. I mean, generally, I think it was fairly predictable, right? Mm. Obviously one battle after another, taking best film. I think it's deserved.
One of six awards that it took.
Yeah, one of six awards. I was really pleased. Obviously, I'm a big fan of Sinners. I was really pleased for Wumi Masaku who won for that. I think it won
best
screenplay as well, didn't it?
So
I was thrilled that Sinners picked up a couple of awards.
And I think it was pretty much, you know, what people predicted for the most part. You know, Jesse Buckley as well. I guess the big surprise, if you like, of the night was Robert Aramayo getting lead actor for I Swear.
You say that, but if anyone had been listening to, I believe it was Absolute Radio over the weekend, they would have had a bright, young, up-and-coming film journalist on there and talking about predictions for the BAFTAs. And that person hedged their bets wildly and said that Robert Aramayo might win Best Actor.
Well, that person really did a good job there. Look, I don't disagree. It's a fantastic performance. And the reason it isn't in the running at any of the other awards is because it hasn't come out in the US, right? The film isn't out until, in theory, April. We'll see if events of this week change that. I thought that was great because I think he's a lovely person and it's a brilliant performance, absolutely off the charts, and it was delightful. So that was a real kind
also,
of,
dude. It's Lord Elrond.
It is Elrond as well. I know.
It was lovely when he was just looking out at the other nominees as well. You know, because the people he was up against: Timothée Chalamet, Leonardo DiCaprio, Ethan Hawke, Michael B. Jordan, and Jesse Plemons. Like that is that must have been quite
heavyweight.
A moment.
It is true.
For him.
The thing is, he's brilliant. But when he went up, he had big competition winner energy, and it was incredibly adorable. But also, it's like, dude, you deserved to win.
Yeah.
You were amazing. So.
Yeah, enjoy that moment, exactly.
And my beloved Hamnet, you know, won Best British Film, which I'm happy with. Like, if we're going to split up the awards a little bit, then great. I'm glad I got something. Nothing was massively surprising. Maybe Stellan Skarsgård not taking Best Supporting Actor for Sentimental Value, which did win Best Film, not in English. But he didn't win Best Supporting Actor. That went to Sean Penn. So that was
He
wasn't there, But that's maybe the biggest... upset question mark of the night.
Do you think this is, I mean, obviously apart from Best Actor, do you think this is how the Oscars are gonna go with these sorts of results?
Broadly, maybe. I can still see Sinners doing a bit better than
I would say
the BAFTAs. I think Sinners should pick up some more of the Oscars.
It looks like Jessie Buckley's got it in the bag, and she's brilliant in that movie. But having now seen Rose Byrne's performance in If I Had Legs I'd Kick You, I'm like, that's the one. That should be it, because there's such a breadth to that performance. Like, there's so many dizzying highs and, you know, so many contrasting emotions from scene to scene.
Yeah.
Whereas you could argue that the Agnes character in Hamnet is relatively...
But you wouldn't, because that would be foolish.
I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't.
With me right here in the room, you wouldn't argue that.
She'll take your eyes out.
I wonder if that film, If I Had Legs I'd Kick You, is almost just too hard for Academy voters.
I think that's
so stressful.
It's so stressful, and it's so in her face and in your face.
Oh, my God.
The film.
Yeah, you feel like you can't breathe watching it, right? It's amazing. Yeah.
All right, enough about the BAFTAs. What else has been happening in the world of movie news? Mike, has anything been happening?
We do have a trailer for the back room.
Toy Story 5.
Toy Story 5. Terrifying.
Hey, Toy Story has its scary moments from time to time,
it
actually.
Does, yeah.
Don't knock it.
It does.
But there is a trailer for the Back Rooms movie, right?
Ooh, what's that?
A24 have made. And it was kind of a sort of... a kind of online kind of creepy pasta turned game experience type thing. This kind of like analog horror creeping around these sort of dark corridors and things pop out at you. And it almost a little bit like that Silent Hill PT kind of demo spin-off. It's got that kind of a vibe.
Okay.
It's being made into a film. So I don't...
That reference was lost on everyone here except me, by the way.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. I'm glad somebody got it. I think it's going to be interesting. I don't, because it's obviously that's not a heavy sort of narrative type of a game or situation. So I'm imagining it's going to be a very vibesy movie.
It's
probably.
Weird. I'm not familiar with the meme that sort of gave birth to this.
Yeah, yeah.
But many people are and have been quite excited about it. The director for this, who I believe is now 20, was, I think, 19 when he made this film, which makes me feel, A, old, and B, like an underachiever. But,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, very much. Well, I mean, to be fair, most people we meet now make us feel old
that
and
is
underachieving.
True.
But yeah, it's kind of like if the Film 4 Productions logo came to life and was made into a film.
That's right, yes.
It looks very creepy. Mm. I'm also impressed by the sheer gumption of their poster, which is basically just some wallpaper, and not particularly attractive wallpaper.
Yes.
With almost invisibly at the bottom, in really small letters, the back room.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It could be, it could be infuriating and pretentious. It could be kind of Skinamarink-esque, or it could be really, really scary. I don't know. It could go one way or the other, judging by that poster and that marketing at the moment, you know?
But yeah, exciting.
Yeah.
We shall see. I mentioned Toy Story 5. There was a trailer for it. Mm. It broke after we recorded last week's podcast. Of course it fucking did.
Of course it did.
Hellspells, did you watch it?
I did, yeah.
It's a big Andrew Stanton stan.
Yeah, I like Andrew Stanton. I think this is an interesting one. I kind of don't know where you go with it. So the idea is here that basically there's a new interactive screen toy called the Lily Pad that all the kids want and all the kids are on all the time. So they're not really playing with toys per se anymore. And so what do the toys do? And they all, in this case, they all panic and they radio Woody and they ask him to come back and help. It seems.
And where is he? Where is Woody?
He's been off on his own adventures at the end of Toy Story 4, you see.
He no longer has an owner, a child, essentially, right?
So it's kind of like, that's an interesting premise. I do worry that there's kind of no happy or even bittersweet ending. Because, they do seem to be
That's where it's going, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true.
So Greta Lee voices Lilypad. She seems quite antagonistic early in this film, but maybe the whole film will be about kind of bringing her around and bringing her into the, you know, the circle of toys.
Mm.
I don't know if they have a name, but they do act like a gang sometimes.
The toy circle.
The toy circle. That sounds wrong.
Toy Illuminati?
It's not, we're going to have to work on it, okay. I don't think. It's not quite
what,
working.
What are you guys excited about this? I mean, yes, Andrew Stanton, James.
James is shaking an audio medium, James. James is shaking
his
head.
If you were going on something for Lent as a sacrifice, it should be animated films. Nothing but animation.
Oh, that's right. He has to
give
watch
up animated movies for Lent. Yes,
no, you have to watch
nothing
but animated films.
Art house and animation.
Oh my God.
And ideally, art house animated films.
Yes, it's Waltz with Bashir, morning, noon, and night for you, my friend.
Exactly.
The Red Turtle. Go. Yeah.
What is this, Persephone?
No,
yes, it fucking is. Persepolis. Damn it, I got that wrong. Damn it, I fucked myself.
I appreciate the gag.
thank you.
Yeah, no. Well, because like Toy Story 2 was wonderful. Toy Story 3 was even better, and then they did Toy Story 4. And I feel like this might be like a
return to form,
right? But like the new Dexter series, a way of kind of putting right what once went wrong. It ended on a sour note, so actually maybe they can use this to redeem it and sort of retcon it,
turn it into a Haribo sour.
Yeah, Sam Beckett style.
What do you mean went wrong? Toy Story 4 was a delight.
I really liked it.
It had Forky.
You do like horrors, so you know.
Yeah,
it was okay. It was no Toy Story 3.
It was
3.
Weak sauce.
Mike mount an impassioned defense of Toy Story 4 immediately.
I can't. No, I remember having fun with it, but I don't remember much about it other than they're in a sort of charity shop and there are some creepy ventriloquist dummies.
Yeah. Keanu Reeves is in it.
Forky. Okay. Well, Forky was a great character, right?
Yeah. Tony Hale.
Not good enough, I would suggest. But.
He's got loads of spin-offs.
I know, they're cute.
There you go. I rest my case,
Your
Honor. Yeah,
that doesn't make the original film cute.
Okay. It was shit. I have folded as well myself. But okay, I'm mildly excited about it.
Every day is Christmas Eve.
Every day.
Might be wonderful.
Yes.
Did we talk last week about the Venom animation plans?
We didn't.
Venom.
Another treat for James.
Pretend, Helen, for a second I've paid no attention to anything that's happened in the last week or so.
Spunk is dead. Long live Spunk.
That is essentially, yes, what we're talking about.
Cartoon Spunk, isn't this hentai?
Oh, no. The Hollywood Reporter is reporting, as is their wont, that in Hollywood, Sony are trying to bring back Eddie Brock and Venom in an animated movie. And they have Final Destination Bloodlines directors Zach Lipovsky and Adam B. Stein attached to direct and produce.
Yes, it's true.
So, yeah, so maybe Spunk lives on in animation.
Yeah.
I'm too expensive for live action, Eddie.
I mean, yes, but also, you know, Spider-Verse movies exist and they're fucking incredible.
They are fucking
incredible.
So maybe some of their incredibleness will rub off on Venom.
Into the Venomverse.
Mm. Lipovsky and Stein won a lifetime pass from me for Final Destination Bloodlines. I also love that they're not just doing the next Final Destination movie, because that would have been the obvious thing for them to do. Instead, they're doing all sorts of other weird shit instead. Yeah, good on them. Yeah.
Good on them.
Cash in those chips, boys. God knows they've worked long and hard to get where they are.
They did that amazing sort of Zoom call prank thing, right?
They did.
It was those guys that set fire to their house and everything. Yeah,
it was amazing.
Incredible.
Do you guys know about this? How they got the gig on?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Their Zoom call. They talked about it on the podcast, where one of them was decapitated by a van, a ceiling fan, not like Wesley Snipes. which would have been a twist.
It really would.
In fairness. But really good stuff. Anything they do is good for me. Hey, you know what else is good for me?
What's that?
Martin Scorsese.
Ooh, he's good for most people.
Yes. He is making another movie. It is called What Happens at Night. It stars Leonardo DiCaprio.
No.
Yes. And Jennifer Lawrence. They're going to be a couple, a married American couple, who travel to a small, snowy European town to adopt a baby. And this week, the cast was, the ranks were swelled or swollen, whatever the word is, by Jared Harris.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a tasty combo.
Yeah. That's the Jared who gets that reaction. When you say
we were all kind of like, oh, God.
Another Jared would have got a kind of, but this gets a, ooh.
It's Harry Seldon, Chris.
Yeah, it is. Mm. That's a Foundation reference.
Oh,
don't worry about it.
I was like, is that his name in Chernobyl? It's unlikely that's his name in Chernobyl.
No, it's not.
Okay. That's Foundation, yeah?
Yes.
That was Foundation, yeah.
All right, well, that's exciting. Good cast. Mads Mikkelsen and his incredible hair. Patricia Clarkson and her incredible hair are also going to be in it. Scorsese going to direct and produce. And the script's been written by Patrick Marber.
Ooh.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's just like 10 out of 10 on paper, yeah.
Peter O'Hanrahan himself. This is amazing.
I'm in. I'm on board.
I love when I make a reference and James, it just dies. I look at James and he just goes, no, I don't know what that
not
is.
Clear
the day to day. The day to day. You ever see the day to day?
No.
It's a comedy. You would not
I don't
like
do
it.
Comedy.
You were too busy gobbling cheese. No,
yeah,
doubt,
that's right.
The time. It's going to stick. That one's going to stick. Anything else you want to talk about?
I do want to mention quickly that there is going to be a film adaptation, apparently, of Lincoln in the Bardo.
Yes, I saw this.
Which is a Booker Prize winning novel that I haven't finished reading, but I'm going to now.
I have read
the
Wikipedia entry about it, and it sounds really good.
The bit I've read has been incredible. What's exciting is, as you might expect, Lincoln is a character in it and is going to be played by Tom Hanks. Super here for that.
Woody himself.
Yes. So it's about Abraham Lincoln following the death of his young son from typhoid. He's a grieving father and interacts with the living and the dead in a sort of way to kind of process his pain. So it's basically kind of Lincoln talking to ghosts.
Wow.
Yeah.
It is exciting. Very exciting.
I'm going to finish the book now because I'm hyped. And this is being directed by Duke Johnson, who co-directed Anomalisa. So, kind of art house cred. James would love it.
For my new Lent viewing schedule.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. That's enough of the movie news for 1 week. Time now for this week's guests. Yes?
Yay.
Yes. It is a double whammy. It is a director-star combo. I like doing these in the podcast. It's not very often you get to talk to a director and an actor, lead actor at the same time, and talk about their relationship and their working relationship together and all that jazz. That's a different movie. And this week's director-star combo is /R, depending on the correct grammar, Mona Fassfold, who is the director of The Testament of Anne Lee and the actress playing Anne Lee, Amanda Seyfried. And apparently it is Seyfried. I've seen a number of interviews with Amanda Seyfried. I always thought it was Seyfried.
I thought it was Seyfried.
Well, there we go. I think it is Seyfried, and I'm pretty sure I've seen her say that herself in interviews and being introduced on talk shows.
Well, she would know.
In that way. You think, right? But here's the thing. What if the way that you think your surname is pronounced is not the way your surname is pronounced? Well, it might be Munker. Mike Munker. We don't know.
Well, wasn't this the whole point that Shruti Gatwa said that he's been pronouncing his own name wrong his entire life because his mum recently corrected him?
Really?
Amazing. Yeah. I love that.
Because the N is not silent, apparently. Yeah. He always thought it was.
He'd always been telling people it was.
Yeah. And so it's not. In Shruti Gatwa.
Yeah. And he didn't know that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
Wow. Mm. That's amazing. Helen O'Hara?
Sure.
Yeah.
O'Hara.
Yeah.
O'Hara. That is my Halloween name.
It is, yeah.
Evolution O'Hara. Evolution O'Hara. Are you going to do a spin-off, Mike? Evolution O'Hara?
Absolutely. Helen, let's talk.
Helen O'Hara is the lesser-known Biffy Clyro song, by the way.
Don't get it. Laughed anyway.
I appreciate that, Chris. Thank you for your charity.
I recognize it was meant to be funny. You know these moments in the podcast where I say something that is clearly funny and you just give me nothing back?
Yeah. I know now why you
see
laugh.
See how I was generous to you there?
Yes. Ha ha ha, Chris. Please feel free to take that and cut it in whenever you say a joke.
This fucking cheesy gobbler, I don't know. Anyway, what if your surname is pronounced like, what if you're Deerer? Right? James Deerer. And what if I'm Chris Hewitt? Because I do bring the wit. And I am a he.
I mean,
so, okay. Anyway, so this film is a testament of Hanley. And this is a film that is, it almost defies description. It is a musical biopic of someone that you probably have never heard of, but someone who is a fascinating figure. So Hanley was a very, very notable figure in the Shaker movement. The Shaker movement are people who are so dedicated to worshipping God that they abstain all sexual intercourse, and they go a bit celibate-y, don't they? And this is a tale of Anne Lee, who was born in Manchester, then moved to America with her brother, played by Bill Pullman's son, Lewis. Bob Pullman. And it unfolds, and there are things in this movie that I never thought I'd see, to be quite frank. It is a very, very ambitious, very, very bold musical. I was really, really taken by this movie, and I jumped at the chance to talk to Seyfried and Fastfold, who, by the way, was also heavily involved in The Brutalist, and her husband is Brady Corbet. And I think that comes up in this conversation.
He co-wrote this one, didn't he?
He co-wrote this one as well. She co-wrote The Brutalist. Yeah. So look at that, division of labor.
Synergy.
That is nice, isn't it? They were in great form. Love talking to them. Here we go. Do please enjoy.
Mona, Amanda, welcome to the Amper Podcast. How are you both?
Good.
Good, good, good. Yeah. Excellent. Before we talk about the film, which is an amazing, amazing film, an amazing achievement, I've noticed, I'm sure you guys have noticed as well, there are people walking around here with T-shirts with your names on it.
Yes.
Yeah. At the moment. How does that make you feel? Does that make you feel weird? Or
I'm just trying to keep it from my mom. Keep him away from my mom.
Yeah.
No, I think it's, it's called Girls on Top, right?
Tops.
Girls on Tops.
Yeah, I keep saying top as well, but feels different.
Yeah,
than girls, tops.
Yeah, Girls on Tops.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's like a nice thing to, you know, lift up female filmmakers and film workers. It's great.
It's a fantastic company.
But it's funny to have your name on a T-shirt.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because it just.
I mean, it's less funny for you because you were like, you've been in franchises. I'm sure there's like pillowcases with like Mamma Mia.
It doesn't say Amanda Seyfried on it. It feels
that's
very personal.
True. Yeah, it's a character. It's different.
Yeah, it's weird. The idea of promoting yourself
your
personally
person.
is very conflicting.
Well, yeah, you do have a lot of like. I mean, I think the idea is that through history, there's been a lot of like, you know, you create icons out of male filmmakers. It's a lot of like icon building, and I think it's the idea is to try and do that with ladies. But then we're way too humble, so we're just like, oh God, please don't talk to me.
Why does it feel different to have your face? To have your name as with your face, because when I see people with my face, it's kind of funny.
Yeah,
like I wear my own T-shirt from The Housemaid of me screaming.
Oh really?
I wear it all the time.
Because
it's a funny shirt and I like the colors.
Yeah. Yeah.
But seeing your name is different, so yeah, it's like I don't belong there.
So you wouldn't necessarily wear one with your name on it, but would you wear each other's T-shirts?
I would wear Mona's for sure. I'll wear Mona's.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's loads there. I'll go and grab you a couple.
There are?
After this. Oh, there's loads.
Great.
I've got loads. Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
Are you gonna which one are you gonna wear?
Well, they don't have my size.
Oh, lie, you know what?
They've only got large, and I'm extra large.
Nah, I don't believe
you're not.
You.
Yeah,
I'm very tight. Mona Fastel, a little tight. It's gonna be great.
Yeah,
it'll be
a little tight if I just go for a little large. But I'll wear a little hot tight.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'll do that. Mm. Anyway, should we talk about the film?
Sure.
Let's talk about the film. We'll get a t-shirt with Anne Lee's name on it. Can you talk about your first meeting and when this working relationship began and blossomed for you? I know, Mona, that you had been obviously working on the movie for quite a while. At what point did Amanda come into your head, and what was that first meeting between the two of you like?
Oh, it was gradual. So we've known each other for a really long time.
Okay.
Gosh, I think we met, like, we were in our 20s when we met, like, early 20s. So
we have a mutual friend.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we didn't. And I got to direct Amanda on a television show. Mm-hmm. I always loved your work, but I guess I knew you more from comedic roles than dramatic roles. And I think that it sort of all clicked when we started working together for me.
Yeah.
When I saw we had some really very dark, really challenging scenes where she was just digging into some and it was also, you were playing an academic, so you had you had challenging texts that was kind of like long speeches and monologues, and so I feel like I was like, all of a sudden the combination, like getting to see that, and then also how the ease of our work relationship, sometimes you work a long time to try and find the key into an actor and trying to figure out, like, how can I support you? How can I be your first audience member? That really, you know, because that's really what you are. You're sitting there behind the monitor. I'm like, I'm the first spectator, and I'm just here to sort of try and guide, try and help you to give your best possible performance. And sometimes that's tricky. Sometimes it takes time with you. For me, it felt immediate, like that it was very easy to act, for us to communicate and to access, to see, you know, I could say one or two things and it would be click into place.
Interesting.
So for me, it was the sum of all those things.
Okay.
Seeing this more dramatic, darker, deeper, older, you know, in my mind, you were still, you know, 21. Yeah, I was like, oh, she's actually the right age to play this role, and she has this dramatic depth, and she's an incredible singer and mover. Yeah. So it was all those things. And I just asked you, I was like, can you do accents? And you were like, definitely.
That was the last thing I checked on. That was the meeting. I was like, how are you with accents?
We were on the phone because I was at the farm, and I was like pacing, and I was like, yeah. I mean, okay, you know, are you sure? But it felt very like she was committed to that idea already. And I was like, okay, well, if she really thinks that I can do this, then I probably can. I just have to wrap my head around it because it's a lot of work. And I like to do a lot of work. But the idea of a lot of work sometimes is depending on the time of day. And you're like, and I was just like, Budapest? I don't go.
No, I pitched it poorly. I don't go
overseas.
We're gonna shoot it in Hungary. You're gonna have to leave your farm. It's gonna be really hard work. The budget's gonna be super tight, you know.
Yeah.
None of the comforts of, you know, of big budget productions will be available to you. Your trailer will be really physically intense. Yes, yeah, so physically
plus
intense.
An accent.
Yeah, that hard
was,
accent.
That was interesting too.
But I was like, but there's going to be animals everywhere.
So yeah, and there were, and she was right.
I was right.
So, Amanda, did you weigh it up? Do you have like a scales going, oh, animals?
No, it wasn't that hard. I think I know what she does is, you know, she gets pretty close to the impossible, and she like jumps off. And I think that when you follow someone who's that brave, you become braver yourself. It is life affirming for sure. And I knew that I was going to have that kind of experience. I knew that I had to just trust. And you know, playing a character like this is very rare opportunity because Anne Lee is just an enigma. Like I think what an amazing experience that's coming to me to play such a, it's a lack of a better term, strong-willed humanist who should be an icon from the 18th century. And you know,
did you know much about her?
I didn't know anything. No, okay. I didn't learn anything about her in American history. I mean, nobody really knows about her except the people who found out about her through weird avenues, just like you. Like you found out about her through a song. It's unless you're really looking hard, you're not going to find her.
Yeah.
So did you go off on your own journey to find Anne, or what was the communication like during prep as you were?
Oh, I mean, my journeys I did separately were all technical, were all very technical. And I didn't really ever go off. I was always either with Celia, Ralston Hall, our choreographer, learning the moves, who also lives pretty close to me upstate, which is very convenient, or on the phone with Mona or on set with Mona, other sets, or you know, at a Mona's house or whatever. You know, I knew our DP really well. And I was working with Daniel Blumberg on Zoom all the time. We were in different studios, recording different songs at different times way before we got to set. I mean, we shot for 2 days up in the Shaker Museum in Massachusetts, like 8 months before we got to Budapest. And we just had all these experiences. Honestly, they all added up to full knowledge when you got onto set. And everything, you know, her and Mona's interpretation of Anne Lee is Mona's interpretation of Anne Lee. Yep. And so I held fast to that.
The musical numbers, for want of a better phrase, in this movie are unlike anything I've ever seen. And Amanda, there are moments in this where I'm always fascinated by actors and how much they're in control of their instrument during sequences like that, where Anne is lost in this reverie. But at the same time, you have to be absolutely precise in your movements.
Yeah.
How difficult was that? And did you ever get lost in a reverie yourself?
I probably did.
There's room for it, though, within the movement.
Yeah.
Because the movement is not supposed to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the thing.
So in Beautiful Treasures, the three different versions, you want to talk about that?
Well, that's the thing. It's like my intention was so clear at that point, and I knew the movements like the back of my hand at that point, like because I'd done it so much. And there were three different places that we were shooting from, three different places in Anne's life, like when she's freshly in love and when she's freshly pregnant and then when she's lost her babies and every time after she loses her babies. And so I just got to explore that song to, you know, I left nothing. There was nothing left to explore. And that's rare, but it is. You get lost every time. And if you don't, I mean, but you also get lost in a way that's just, you are just connected and it's connected to everything you're supposed to be connected to as the vessel, you know? And because I had so much time to prepare, I was every take I was able to kind of experience something new, as an actor. It's great. It's very rare. But Beautiful Treasures was, and Hunger and Thirst too. I just, I understood the intention.
Was that tricky because the camera is right in your face? And
No, because there was also, you know, the camera operator and I had been working together for months together on a TV show. And and it was like we moved perfectly together, really. And there was so much work that went into the preparation that went into the camp, like the relationship between the camera and me. And
it was later in the schedule too, and he had been part of rehearsals with us as well. So both our cinematographer and our operator would come in, and you know, I would bring them into dance rehearsals so that they have to practice the movement as much as
you have to be in it. You have to feel like you're in it when you're in. Like, and it's really important.
Mm-hmm. And no one to really anticipate one another, because that's what you're really trying when you're doing. Performers doing movement and then the camera is doing movement as well. You just ideally you want there to just be unity in that, in the timing of that, rather than one anticipating the other.
Yeah.
Especially not the camera anticipating the movement, because you really want the sort of it to feel driven by it. But
I think you also have something like All This Summer, where that is, I'm guessing, just so precise because you're cross-cutting between different times mm-hmm. of the year, and each mm-hmm. cut blends perfectly with the next. Mm-hmm. So that must have been a nightmare to make, or was it quite?
It was hard.
Well, it was hard.
The boat was smaller than we thought.
Well, not than I thought. You guys just ignored that my. I had gone there. I had measured it. The camera angles were extremely precise as to where I could put the camera and what would work for the shots on this boat. And I also and there was many things that were not movable. There's like this coil of rope has to be there. It's a security thing. This is a real boat, and this thing is this is another thing that this big thing, poly thing that can't be moved. So I taped everything up in the dance studio and I was like, this is your parameters. This is where the camera is. And my choreographer was like, cool, 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 great. No problem. Let's do it. And I would just watch rehearsals and I would just see you all just dancing on top of my tape, disrespecting it completely. And I'd be like, God damn it. Then we get on the boat in Sweden and Celia is just like, well, this isn't going to work. this is a nightmare. You guys were absolute complete rubbish for the first rehearsal. It was a disaster. I was just like sweating watching you, thinking what are we going to do here? And then we just started making the movement smaller, but really still precise. Mm-hmm. And then we rehearsed and we rehearsed and we rehearsed. Yeah. And then you guys were wonderful and great.
We had so much fun.
And in the last version we did with big rain towers, off to the dock because the boat was docked. Uh-huh. And I couldn't afford a big crane because budgets. So in the end, we ended up rigging the camera off the tower, which is a crazy thing to do. But the beauty that happened in that final couple of takes in the rain was that finally, because their clothes were just way down in water, and you were wearing this leather coat that just became incredibly heavy, all of a sudden the movement was just beautiful. It was truly, that was our favorite movement take, because the pull, the gravity sort of pull of the heaviness of these period costumes were just like,
yeah, it
really made the movement so beautiful. And you were exhausted.
It's a really good metaphor for what they were going through. Like, no matter what, no matter the way the world was structured at that time, they were going to get through it, and they were going to prevail. And with that batting down rain, that incredible downpour, we just were something else was happening for us. Mm. And it was cool. It looked cool. Felt cool.
Did you get that sense of what Mona was going through at that point, that you were snatching victory from the jaws of defeat as the sequence went on?
I guess we were all like, fuck you. Look at us go. Like, no. Fuck all of you. We're still dancing. Look at us. Like, it was kind of like we're like a punk band for a second.
Yeah, it's like, let's do the show right here. Yeah.
Get it on. It did feel a little bit like that.
Yeah.
Amazing. I've got to let you go in a second. But Mona, at what point did the idea, because you almost stumbled upon Anlie, right, in discovering her and this concept of the Shakers and celibacy and what they stood for. At what point did you think, okay, yes, this is someone whose story I need to tell, and in this fashion as well?
Well, it was a long process. When I first discovered, one of the draw to the story for me beyond just sort of the aspects of the story that's, her feminism, her radical thoughts around mm-hmm. community and equality. To me, her story is just so deeply cinematic. And I wanted to do, my background is in dance and movement. And so for me, going into a project where I could really explore modern dance and movement and then continue my collaboration with Daniel Blumberg, who I mm-hmm. worked really closely with on The World to Come, which was his first score.
Yeah.
So for me, just deepening that sort of the collaboration with Celia Rosenhall and Daniel, and it was all of those aspects. And then it was just something that felt really, I think I was so excited to take, I felt
a deep need and want that was just felt almost like it's sort of a possession. You know, I was possessed by this urge to take this story that was forgotten in history and then give it this like freaking like epic treatment.
Yeah.
I wanted it to feel like this grand, you know, piece of sort of like Americana Hollywood-ish sort of feel to it. So I was like, we're going to shoot on 35. We're going to have these massive matte paintings and big sets, and we're going to cross the ocean. And we're going to burn shit down. and somehow doing that felt really subversive with this character.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, oh, I'm going to tell this little story about her, a day in her life, or something very like, you know, minimizing, which so often happened with female historical figures. I was like, I'm going to give her this unknown woman is going to get this epic treatment. Of course, no one else thought that way. So, it was incredibly hard to raise the money for the film. Yeah, and in the end, the budget was tight. But we still just said,
when Amanda comes aboard, that must help as well, though.
Yeah, yeah, of course it does, but not really. I mean, you know, not
they
in
still
this.
Still are like, okay, good luck, you. Good luck, girls.
Good luck, you know. And then, so, you know, we had to make it for the similar, you know, budget level as The Brutalist. There's old tricks that they use in old, you know, in filmmaking before we had all the tools that we have now. So we just utilize a lot of them, a lot of sort of traditional tools of filmmaking, like, for example, matte paintings and, you know, things like that.
Love a matte painting.
Yeah.
Love a matte painting.
So beautiful. Fantastic. So beautiful.
I still don't understand what that is.
I've talked about it so many times.
I know, but I can't picture it.
Well, you can, though. It's just
because you're from the green screen era. And
it's basically...
Everything gets pumped in afterwards.
Yeah, so we basically, you know, I photograph the hillside. You're standing right there in front of it, and then that, you know, I shoot that on 35. That image goes back to my painter Lito. He hand paints Manchester, the whole city behind you, to that picture, matching the light, matching, you know, our mimicking our lens. We film shoot that on 35. We marry that with VFX with our image. And then I work with a VFX artist as well to animate few little bits and pieces of it. Like birds that I bring in. For example, like I bring in real birds from another shot, maybe put that in and have them fly across the screen. Or
that has blown my mind.
I'll have little, you know, one little person.
You should have had a cow flying.
I did bring a cow.
My own cow
that I put in and made smaller and put in. So it's a combination of old filmmaker techniques like the matte paintings combined with, you know, the use of modern VFX. And to me, the combination of the two is really beautiful and special.
Amazing. Amanda, I watched your brain get blown in real time there. That was amazing. You looked troubled for a while.
It's just a lot of work. It's amazing. I just love something that's tedious.
Yes.
I think it's so amazing to watch it kind of grow and become something.
Everything in this film is inspired by that sort of idea of Shakerism where it's all handcrafted.
Yeah.
It's made in a sustainable way. It's made with thought around sort of, it's dedicated, you know, thousands of hours to hand making something and making it special.
Okay, that was Mona Fassfold and Amanda Seyfried. And if you're looking for more interviews, our new spin-off show, The Interviews, the latest episode of that is up, and it features in-depth conversations with Rose Byrne, the aforementioned Rose Byrne, her incredible turn in If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, Neve Campbell talking about Scream 7. Hey, if you want to hear more Neve Campbell, she's on Mike's podcast.
You can watch it on the Evolution of Horror YouTube channel. Yes.
That's exciting. Good stuff indeed. Is that the Hello Sydney podcast?
It is also on the Hello Sydney podcast, yes.
God, Mike, I'm plugging stuff for you.
Chris. Thank you.
I get nothing.
Mike, do you regularly plug the Barley TV podcast on Evolution of Horror? Because if not, I really should.
Can you please, can you give that up for Lent?
Absolutely not. I think Jesus would want me to do it.
I think Jesus would fucking hate the Pilot TV podcast.
I mean, respectfully disagree.
I think he wrote a review, right, on the comment section. Father, forgive them, they know not what they do.
Wow.
Anyway, should we talk about movies now? there's only one place to start, and that is Scream 7, obviously. Mike.
Yes.
Horror is evolving.
Oh, my God. That Scream is still going. Scream is still going. 30 years since Scream 1996.
I know. It's wild.
And it's crazy, isn't it? So, well, obviously, this is... Thank you. This is the seventh entry in the franchise. Obviously, the last movie we got a few years back, Scream 6, was missing Neve Campbell, Sydney Prescott. But she's back in a big way in this movie. So it very much kind of focuses on Sydney and what she's been up to. This movie is directed by Kevin Williamson, who obviously kind of conceived the story for the original. He wrote the original movie. He wrote the first two. I think he wrote Scream 4 as
well. He wrote some of Scream 3. Scream 3.
A little bit, but there
was... I can't say that.
Scream Aaron 3. Kruger kind of rewrote it, really. And then he was not really involved in 5 and 6. Yep. So I think for a lot of the fans, particularly of the original films, this is very much kind of bringing the series back to its roots, because we've got Kevin Williamson at the helm, and we've got Neve Campbell very much in a starring role again. Really kind of the biggest role she's had in a Scream movie probably since about Scream 2, I think, you know, because I think in a lot of the other sequels she's kind of come and gone almost as sort of like extended cameos almost, or she sort of turns up in the final act.
So we
meet Sydney Prescott. She's now living in a new town. She's got a teenage daughter who is called Tatum, named after the Rose McGowan character from Scream 1. She's played by Isabel May, and wouldn't you know it, there's a ghost face killer on the loose, stabbing and slashing his way through various different teen characters and people in Sydney's life. This movie kind of, again, very much plays on the sort of nostalgia and harking back to kind of the ghosts of Sydney's past as well. There are some, and I won't spoil anything about this, obviously, because I think so much of it is about the mystery and not giving too much away. But I think, you know, it has been revealed in a lot of the marketing that various actors from previous movies who have played characters that are dead are also make appearances in this movie as well. So David Arquette, who had played Deputy Dewey Riley, is in this movie, as is Matthew Lillard, who played Stu in Scream 1 back in 1996. So it very much kind of, it's having a lot of fun playing on kind of nostalgia. It feels like it's very much made for the fans, this one. Generally, I really enjoyed it. I think it's got some great sort of tense horror set pieces. There's a great scene that, again, you kind of get hinted at in the trailer, involving Sydney and her daughter kind of being stalked within the walls of their house, which I think is a great little Scream set piece. It's very stabby. It's got some, you know, it's got some pretty gnarly gore in it as well. And I think if you're a Scream fan, you're generally going to probably have fun with this movie. It never reaches the heights of the early films of Scream and Scream 2, but I kind of don't feel like any of the movies since then have done that.
I think 6 has.
Well, so 6 is a lot of fun, but I would say they're all kind of 3-star movies post Scream 2. And I think this one is very much the same. I think it is like solid fun. Kevin Williamson, I think, is better at the character stuff than he is at the horror. And I think this is a great movie. It's a great vehicle for Neve Campbell. It's a great Sydney Prescott movie. I don't think maybe it's as good a horror film as Scream 6.
Sydney Prescott, or should we say Sydney Evans, lovely Welsh surname there.
Yes, because she's married to Joel McHale's Mark Evans.
Yes.
So the Mark wasn't the Mark from Scream 3 that she was married to.
That was Mark Kincaid.
I feel cheated. But anyway, whatever. I pretty much agree with Mike. I am a wimp, so I was scared through a lot of this. I found some of the kills quite gory. I mean, Scream's always been very bloody, but not always very visceral in the literal sense. I feel like you get quite a lot of viscera here. But I did find the set pieces pretty effective. What I find a bit less effective was just the plotting, which we won't get into until we get into the spoiler for the most part.
Yep.
But I will say that there's just some moments of, you know, obviously the traditional Scream elements of whodunit, who can we trust? You know, the sort of...
Everyone's a suspect,
getting them in the room and having those conversations. There was none of the really, like, let's discuss the rules of a horror movie kind of stuff this time. And I get maybe why you have to move away from that, because it's been done and done and done, but at the same time...
That's kind of what its thing
is. It's a part of Scream.
Yeah. Well, can I ask a question about that? Like, when did they move away from the meta-ness?
I mean,
with this movie, isn't
it? Just with this one.
So it has, because hilariously, not only have I not seen this, I have not seen any Scream since Scream 3. We did a movie marathon. We were going to do Scream 1, Scream 2, Scream 3 tonight. I think it was the week before the Scream 4 press screening. And we did the movie marathon, and I never saw 4, I never saw 5, I never saw 6, and I haven't seen 7.
Wow. Now,
I'm not going to break this streak. I'm never watching another Scream film.
Oh, I mean,
so I genuinely don't know the answer to that, but that's an interesting.
So you've given that up for Lent.
Yeah, I've given up Scream for all Lents from now until the end of time.
It's not that it's bad. I just felt like it wasn't quite as sharp or as crisp as I like my Scream movies to be. I thought there were some moments of sentimentality which felt un-Scream. I mean, obviously, there's always been friendships. There's always been people who care about each other. There's been love stories. But but actual sentiment, I find a bit out of place.
Yeah. Yes, it goes a bit Dawson's Creek almost or something, doesn't it? And
now I'm in. You've got my attention now.
And, you know, nothing against any of the cast. I thought they're all good. They're all, you know, there's not all of them have very much to work with, but I thought Isabel May as Sydney's daughter was actually pretty good, and they have a quite nice sort of spiky relationship, and enjoyed lots of that. I just felt like there were really good actors in here, especially among the young cast, who got nothing to do. And I would have liked maybe a little bit more room to breathe for some of them. So I think like 3,
I think for a lot of fans, particularly fans of the original who were quite upset that they didn't get Sydney Prescott in 6 and didn't get much of her in 5, I think there's a lot they'll really enjoy about this movie. It really kind of, it is really reverent towards that character. And, you know, she's the star, isn't
it's
she?
It's good to have her back. And obviously the making of this movie was beset on all sides by all kinds of
fuckery,
and I'd love to have an alternate universe ticket to Christopher Landon's Scream 7 that stars Melissa Barrera and Jenna Ortega, but the aforementioned fuckery means we were deprived of that. And you can maybe see that this movie was put together fairly quickly and they were moving around some parts, and maybe as a result it doesn't quite hang together as well as some of the previous installments. But you know, I love Scream 6. For me, this is a step down from that movie, but, you know, gore hounds will be satisfied and then some. So we've given this one 3 stars, I believe. 3 stars for Scream 7. Next up, Helen O'Hara. I would say Amanda Seyfried is a strange choice to play Stan Lee, but...
it's Anne Lee, but it is about True Believers.
Enough said, True Believers.
So this is the story of Anne Lee, who was a mother of the Shaker movement. So she is born in Manchester, part of a huge family of kids. She witnesses her parents having sex at a young age and is kind of scarred for life by it, and has some complicated relationship of her own with her husband, who's played here by Christopher Abbott, and loses her 4 children. I mean, you can imagine the trauma of that.
Oh,
and
my turns, God. That sequence.
That sequence is so upsetting. But she turns to religion, obviously. She's always been religious. She's always felt herself called to God. But she particularly turns to religion after that. And she's experimented with some of the sects and the groups that were kind of springing up in England at that time. Mm-hmm. This is in the 1740s, 50s. And she finds the Quakers, essentially, and their offshoot, the Shakers, and becomes central to that movement and is instrumental in taking them across the Atlantic to find their church in America. That's the kind of bare bones. There's a lot more to it than that, about, you know, the kind of the business, I guess, of religion. In some ways, this is a film that digs into, hey, who funded this religious sect across the sea and why? This is a film that gets into, hey, what is persecution like for a religion? You know, it gets into some of those kind of big questions around the founding of this movement. But it is also about a woman who is very sincere in her faith and is able to carry huge numbers of people with her in that belief and in that faith, because she is so evidently sincere in everything that she does. And it's carried through in this film that that feels very rooted in nature, almost like Hamnet was, and almost like The Brutalist was until it went concrete focused, you know. And it feels very, very closely observed, and then also has this breaking into song. And I think it's a really clever device, because it does sort of take you into the sense of religious ecstasy that they all experience, because it is the only ecstasy they allow themselves, because the other kind is sinful, guys. but it's kind of trying to communicate that sense of fervor and that sense of you know, almost magical realism that they felt and that powered them to basically set up in the wilderness and try and tame it. So I thought it was really effective that way. I'm not saying these are all pop bangers. These are going to be breakout hits.
These are original Shaker songs from the time.
Oh, wow.
As well.
Oh, so, I didn't know that. Well done. Okay. Yeah. But I think they're really haunting. And I find myself haunted by this film after seeing it and kind of thinking about it for days after. So it's kind of stuck with me more than I thought it would. I don't know that it always gets into her fundamental psyche. And maybe it's hard to do that because, you know, religious ecstasy and sort of, you know, a sense of mission is a very alien thing to most people. But it is... So I maybe you could have gone harder into that, but I think I still thought it was really good, and I thought it was an incredible Amanda Seyfried performance.
I'm a bit disappointed that Amanda Seyfried wasn't in the Oscar conversation a bit longer than she probably should have been, because she's really, really terrific in this. We gave it 4 stars. 4 stars then for The Testament of Anne Lee. All right, next up is a film that we have absolutely unequivocally given 5 stars to, Sirat. James.
Yes, indeed.
That lover of art house.
Hey. I am a profound lover of Spanish cinema, as we all know. This is Oliver Lax's film, and it stars Sergi Lopez as Luis. And this film begins, as all good films should, with a rave. Banging tunes, fat beats, the whole 9 yards.
Like Blade.
Much like Blade, yes.
Okay, cool.
New Order, indeed. Confusion, the pump panel reconstruction mix. So it starts with an extended rave sequence. Luis turns up with his son Esteban, and he's handing out flyers. He's looking for his missing daughter. She has been missing for quite some time. He speaks to a number of ravers to try and locate her until he finds someone who says, there's another rave that's going to be in the desert, because this is the Moroccan desert. It's the Sahara, essentially, isn't it? And he said that it's deeper in the desert. There's another rave, another mystical rave. She might be at that one. So when the army come to disperse this illegal rave in the desert, he tags along with a sort of convoy of other ravers to find this other rave where his daughter might be. All of which is kind of narrative setup for a story. Now, is a story that never actually arrives. And this film genuinely made me feel like an idiot. So I came into the office and I literally said, could someone explain to me Sirat? And the reason why I asked for it to be explained is, one, we've given it 5 stars. 2, it's been nominated for 2 Oscars, including Best International Film.
Yeah.
It won the jury prize at Cannes. It won the Palm Dog, for fuck's sake.
It won the Palm Dog.
Such a good boy.
It is Luis and Esteban and their little dog, too. And they head off on this sort of, I guess, it's like a road to perdition. It really is. But... So Sirat is an Arabic word, and it's for the kind of the Islamic concept of this sort of bridge between heaven and hell. And I guess that is as close as a metaphor for this film as you can get, because as I said, it sets up a story that never really comes.
Right.
Because it is 100% pure vibes from that moment on. They're just in this weird purgatory of the desert, and it kind of plays out, and the sound is actually incredible. Not just the music, which is all composed by Kangding Ray, who is, as I understand it, a purveyor of fat beats. And
it's on his business card.
It is on his business card. But it's literally just the ravers sort of talking and dancing and listening to music and never really going anywhere and never really doing anything. Like, from a narrative point of view, it takes a turn. Not so much from a narrative point of view. There is an event, and then there are some other events, which I obviously can't talk about. So from a mood point of view, it goes from that, this is weirdly hypnotic and trance-like and extremely techno, to, oh my God, this is bleak and horrific. But it still doesn't go anywhere. And I had this discussion with Empire's Reviews editor, John Nugent, and he was saying that what this film did more than anything is it made him want to go to a rave. Because we should say Oliver Lax is he's really into techno music. He loves raves. He's been to many, many raves. And I think part of it was his attempt to capture the feeling of being at these events. And the music is hypnotic. I have never been off my tits on Disco Biscuits, so I've never really experienced this myself. But a couple of people in the office were like, it really got them and made them feel like they were in their early 20s again. So perhaps that's why I didn't understand it. But I found this experience of watching this film mesmerizing, yes, but also quite hollow, because I felt like it was setting up, don't do it. I felt like it was setting up something. Like, instead of, I wanted to know, are you going to find your daughter? Does she want to be found? She's an adult. Maybe she's, you know, missing for a reason. Like, But the it's like vapor. It just evaporates. The plot disappears into the air to be replaced with techno.
It's like way existential.
It is extremely existential. And I kind of almost get what they're going for, but I felt robbed of, you know, a story. Yeah. And I mean, look, it's not going to be for everyone. And it definitely wasn't for me. And for some people, it's been transcendental, like the most magical film they've seen, this incredible experience that stirs the soul and is a joy for the senses. And I think there is definitely an element of that that I can see, but also no.
I don't know about joy. I feel like there's quite a lot of darkness
Before,
in here.
Like the first half.
The second half then follows. You see, that's the problem. So the second half is much darker and absurdist, I think, and borderline surreal at times. And really, I genuinely think this is a sort of story of existence and essentially what is the point of struggling on when life is bleak and meaningless at times and bad things happen to good
people. I felt exactly like that watching this film.
Yeah, but I think that's what it was trying to say. And I think the point is you keep going on anyway because life is the point. And I think that's what the film is telling us. As such, there were times where I was like, oh my God, turn back. What are you doing? You're stupid people. Stop it. You clearly do not have enough water and oil to cross the desert. There are no convenient supermarkets. Go back. Find a convenient supermarket. But that's not the point of the film, is it? You know, it genuinely becomes an internal journey at a certain point. And I thought it was really powerful, and it has stayed with me in a month or two since I saw it.
It's the first film I've seen in which a dog gets off its tits on LSD.
God, that is so stressful.
That was really stressful. Yeah.
I thought it was such a stressful experience, particularly the second half. And I mean that in the best possible way.
I loved
it. I think this is like the first proper like five-star movie I've seen this year, I think.
You're just rubbing it in now, aren't you? Yes, I didn't understand it, Mike.
But I sort of agree with what you mean. It does abandon the story that's set up and it becomes something very different. I just loved what it became in the second half. I was so tense. I was like covering my eyes in places. Mm-hmm. It becomes this kind of survival horror movie almost in its second half. It reminds me of things like William Friedkin's Sorcerer and stuff as well.
It turns into The Wages of Fear, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But hasn't he talked about the fact that it was like inspirations for this were as varied as Mad Max Fury Road and The Wacky Races.
Right.
And it was this idea of just trucks going endlessly through the desert. So it almost is like a twisted fever dream that's just been shot.
There is a bit of Mad Max to it too, because it almost feels like we're in some sort of a post-apocalyptic world.
So there is a world war, you get the impression, going on.
Something is
beyond
happening.
The sort of realms of what this film shows.
I was very much here for the kind of existential spiritual journey that it took us on. But you're absolutely right, it's not for everyone. It's very much not for everyone.
It is very much an LSD trip in and of itself. So.
Yeah.
Five stars then. And we'll probably win an Oscar.
Not many five-star movies defied our panel as much as that one did, but it sounds exciting. Although, frankly, techno, no thanks.
Techno.
I went to Fatboy Slim last week, actually, as well. So this was very well-timed, you know? I was with a bunch of Gen Xers.
How was he? Was he all right?
He was amazing.
Did he do a song?
He did some songs. He did some songs.
Good stuff. Five stars then for Sirat. And last but least, this week is The Bluff.
Yeah.
You can bluff it, Helen.
Oh, I've seen it. I don't need to.
Oh, good.
Yeah. This is a pirate movie. Swashbuckles.
Arr. Is it R-rated?
It is R-rated. They're not normally R-rated. When's the last time we saw an R-rated pirate film?
So anyway, this comes from Frank E. Flowers, who is a Caymanian director, and this was set on Cayman Brac, which is one of the islands in the Cayman Islands, obviously. I just enjoyed that because I've been to Cayman Islands. I haven't been very many tropical places, but I've been there. Yes, I came in. Yeah. No, just Grand Cayman, actually.
From Star Wars.
So this stars Priyanka Chopra Jonas, I believe we're calling her these days.
I believe we are, yes.
As a retired pirate who is living peacefully with her family on Cayman Brac. Her husband is played by Ismael Cruz Cordova. We've had Elrond today. Now here we have another elf from Rings of Power.
Whose name we absolutely remember.
Definitely remember, but we're just giving listeners the chance to think about it.
Elfrond, I think you'll find.
Oh, boy. Anyway, But he gets captured by an evil pirate who I think is meant to be Northern Irish.
I think he might be. It's not clear.
Who's played by Carl Urban. And he's looking for his lost treasure, which it turns out, wouldn't you know it, Priyanka might have stolen.
Oh.
Yeah. And his sidekick is Temuera Morrison. So it's a really good cast. You've also got Sophia Oakley Green as her sister-in-law, actually. Okay. Not her daughter. But these good, you know, seafaring folks have to now defend their island and their home against bad pirates. I mean, honestly, some nights that's all I need from a film. And that's good because that's pretty much all this film is. There are some pretty good fight scenes.
Yeah.
Chopra has been doing her workouts and she is really, really impressive.
Chopra Jonas to you.
Chopra Jonas, sorry. She's been doing her workout. She's really, really impressive and though she's very good. She's very committed. I actually thought that accent wobbles aside, Carl Urban was having quite a lot of fun and I enjoyed him. I didn't think it was bad. I just, like, it's not great. It's not going to revive the pirate movie.
It's not.
But, like, if it's just Friday night and you've had enough and your brain has already switched itself off, this is the film to watch.
Well, it wants to be kind of Jane Wick with cutlasses, doesn't it, really? Like, it's like, yeah, I'm thinking she's back.
It's a little like, bit. It's a little bit Cutthroat Island-y.
Right. Yeah. It turns out she's, like, I mean, it's in the trailer. You can say, like, she's a badass former pirate herself and she kills the shit out of a whole bunch of people. But it is, I mean, Syrah is obviously very plot light, but not Vin Valley. This doesn't have that much more in terms of narrative than that did. Like, it's a very, very simple setup, and then there's lots and lots of people getting killed. Mm. I mean, the trailer pretty much spells out exactly what this is. Some of the dialogue in this film is actively toe-curling. Like, she's like, you're a criminal. This criminal is your only hope. And then they came looking for Bloody Mary, and bloody is what they're gonna get. I mean, that's the level here. It is super cheesy. It is super silly. Some of the, you know, the kills are quite inventive, mm-hmm. you know, with booby traps and whatnot. But ultimately, it's incredibly obvious where this goes. It's incredibly obvious where it ends. And it's 2 hours long, so it outstays its welcome. It really does. There's a couple of really great scenes in it, but I was very bored after about the hour mark and it was still going. And then you're like, oh, thank God I'm at the end. And you're like, no, there's half an hour left because they're going to draw this out still further. And it's just like, this didn't need that runtime.
It should
have been a tight 75 and this would have been spot on.
Yeah.
You best start believing in pirate stories, Miss Swan. You're in one.
I was literally about to do that.
Of course you were.
Instead of doing that, I was going to go, you best start believing in shit pirate movies, Miss Chopra Jonas.
That's
you're
harsh.
In one.
That's harsh.
That's harsh, but fair.
2, 3, 4, 5? Five stars.
I think he got a very generous 3 stars.
A very generous three stars.
It's there around the 2-3 borders, let's be honest.
Sounds like a treasure.
Perhaps raiding across the border occasionally.
Yeah. It's...
Mm. All right. 3 stars then for The Bluff. And on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by... another director star combo, Chris. What? That's right. Only this time the director is Maggie Gyllenhaal, writer-director of The Bride! Exclamation mark.
Whoa.
And her star, the Oscar-bound,
surely,
Jessie Buckley. But in the meantime, all that remains is for me to say goodbye to my 3 colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, Mike Munzer.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I've loved it.
Excellent. Where can people find you? I want postcodes.
Come and find my podcast if you like horror movies, Evolution of Horror.
Give people your assassination coordinates, Mike.
No. Just come and find my podcast instead, Evolution of Horror.
Evolution of Horror. And hey, we're doing something, aren't we, on Friday the 13th?
Come and see that. If you happen to be in London or within reach of London, it's Friday the 13th in March, Friday the 13th of March. Me and Chris and Becky Dark will be on stage talking about the Friday the 13th movies and screening part 6, I believe, Jason Lives, as that's its 40th anniversary as well.
The second best one? Maybe the best one.
It's up there. It's top 3. Yeah.
It's top. I mean, it's a fucking low bar, but yes.
Yeah.
So that's very exciting. Goodbye to the cheesy gobbler himself, Team Jim. Goodbye, James Dyer.
Goodbye, Chris. I'm, of course, giving up all mainstream movies. I'll be watching Syrat exclusively for the next 40 days. Oh, God.
Goodbye, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Toodaloo.
I'm off to see Dracula again.
You are off to see Dracula. Are you inviting James?
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm going.
No, she's going with Mike.
People.
Apparently,
that's all right. So, we're off. Yeah. We're off.
Oh, well, you know, he seemed keen.
Oh, yes. James, the uninvited cheesy gobbler, Dyer. Oh, such a shame. Anyway, listen. Hey, all this talk of Dracula reminds me that I haven't yet finished my story about how I nearly stepped on Florence Pugh's dress.
Oh, and it was a scintillating one.
Well, come closer. The thing is, you see...